Yes, I want to talk about what I call as a general rubric for today and tomorrow, new lifestyles in America. And I would like to change, as I mentioned, as Ron announced in breakfast, I'd like to change today's a little bit. I had it originally thought about reducing our standard of living, but I think that's a fairly, you know, well understood item that wouldn't require a great deal of explanation. And I will be bringing that particular sort of subtopic into what I'm talking about. But a few weeks ago, just before, in fact, just after school ended and before we came out here, obviously, Vern and I had the opportunity, I suppose that's the best way of putting it, it's really an obligation, to serve on what the we called at St. Olaf the Doomsday Committee. The dean didn't like it to have us call it that because we aren't supposed to be thinking negatively about the future. But what it was politely called was the Long Range Planning Committee, and we it came up with Doomsday, because the future isn't, you know, really all that bright. And it got me thinking about this thing we call futuristics and what to expect in the future. So far as our school life was concerned, and at, specifically at that particular point at St. Olaf, and also as I know we're interested in here, specifically as to what our what will be the future really of our religious lifestyles in this country. I'm not suggesting there's going to be a major kind of change in terms of our theology or anything along this line, but what I would like to talk about today is what I call the new parish. That is to outline some of the forces, I think, that are at work in our society today, that have been at work in our society, and which really will, I think, make quite a bit of difference so far as our future parish life is concerned. I think almost all of us here are concerned with the parishes back home, and therefore maybe we could think along the lines that I want to outline today. And I was especially impressed with a book which has just come out, Lyle Schaller. I can get this for the bookstore later on. I got it a week before we left. Lyle Schaller, who is involved in long-range church planning, this is brought out by Abingdon, Understanding Tomorrow. And he's dealing in this topic we call futuristics. Now, some of you might wonder, you know, when you look at sort of my credentials, what is a historian doing talking about the future? And the only answer to that is that's what we can do at Holden. I can't do it back home professionally, but that's one of the advantages. That's one of the advantages of being at Holden, is that we can do just the opposite, really. I'm supposed to be looking at the past instead of the future, but today, by golly, I'm going to look at the future. And my chairman isn't around to listen, so we can see. We'll see what happens now. What Schaller points out, what I would like to start with, and I want to stay fairly close to the text here, although I don't like to, because I'd much rather, you know, have what they like to call significant eye contact. But that aside, I think I'd better stick to the text here, because it might add a little bit more focus for discussion. I think really a new lifestyle is imperative for our parishes, because there have been so many changes really that have taken place in the last 10, 15 years in American life. Many of the older truths, many of the older sources of conventional wisdom, of loyalty, simply make no sense when we start thinking about the future. Things we took for granted, things or conditions that we depended on, are really, I think, rather disappearing rather rapidly in our world. And it seems as though we are in a position, and I would suggest, in the sort of the last half of this decade, now that we're into the last half of the 1970s, to make some rather basic decisions about the kind of lifestyle we want. And I think at Holden and in our local communities, we want to have our understanding of the future informed and directed, I think, by our religious commitments. So what I'm trying to suggest is that I'd like to propose or outline some of the major changes that have taken place, and then in the last half try to suggest how this will possibly, I think probably, make a difference so far as our parish life and the religious lifestyle, if you want to put it that way, in those parishes are concerned. And first of all, to get at this, I think I want to outline very briefly some diagnostic facts, some things that simply speak for themselves, but will focus our energy on what I'm talking about so far as these long-range changes and profound transformations have to mean in terms of our concern today. And here I have to make a couple of qualifications, because it seems when we're talking about the future, we are really talking about two kinds of change. One kind of change in talking about the future is obviously technological change. And the problem in thinking about the future and thinking about our lifestyle specifically is that we know that technology is going to come along with all kinds of new products, all sorts of changes that will alter much of our way of life, and that these are very unpredictable. We simply don't know what will happen so far as many of these are changed, and therefore we have to be rather careful and cautious about that. But at the same time that there is rapid technological change taking place in our society, I think we will recognize something that we've learned in the past, that is that interpersonal relationships will change, I think, at a much slower pace. That is, people seem far more willing, I think, to adjust to technological change than to those affecting their personal lives. And that's, for instance, why I think the nuclear family, why the worshiping the congregations have survived change for such a long period of time, because we are much less willing to change some of our interpersonal relationships than we are willing to change to technology. And furthermore, so far as change is concerned, I think although there will be rapid technological change, there'll be resistance to change in interpersonal relationships. No matter what happens, I think all the changes will create or will certainly increase more complexity in our lives, not less. We always talk, and all the political candidates this year are talking about reducing, you know, complexity and red tape and bureaucracy and so on, and I think that's fine, but I think in realistic terms, what's happening in our lives, as I'll try to show in a little while, is that they're going to continue to be more complex so long as we make certain kinds of demands on our institutions. So long as we expect our government, our schools, our churches to do certain things, they're going to increase. This is going to increase in the complexity, the bureaucracy, the red tape in our world, and the only thing to do really is to adjust to it as best we can. All right, so much for sort of some qualifications about predicting the future. Now, what can we sort of really count on so far as broad diagnostic conditions in our world are concerned? I think, and I say you just fill in the details on this for yourself, I think the energy shortage will continue to get worse rather than better. I think there will be a continuing decrease in the birth rate, which has been pretty well documented now. I think we hit ZPG last year, if I'm not mistaken. Somebody can correct me on this. But didn't we hit ZPG last year, zero population growth? And it's beginning to go below that now. All sorts of things are at work here. For instance, there were fewer marriages in 1975 than there were in 1974, and yet there are supposedly more people, which would indicate some drastic changes are going to take place there. So there's going to be a continuing energy crisis, there's going to be a decreasing birth rate, there is going to be an increasing, I think, demand on the part of the poorer people, the less wealthy people, for more control over their lives, far more than had been the case, I think, in, say, the 1950s or even for the 1960s. And that there is going to be more demand on the part of more people to make more institutions, like the government, like the schools, like the churches, serve their particular needs. I think this is really one of the most significant developments that's taken place recently. What really is at the heart, to put this in a sort of a broad perspective here, what really is at heart, I think, of these changes which we're talking about and which will really, I think, direct the kind of lifestyles we're going to have in the future, is something that Schuller calls the Big Revolution, which started to take place in the 1960s, and that we are he argues that there was a basic change and alteration really that took place in our way of life, in our way of thinking, in our institutions, the whole way we simply understood and perceived, you know, the world around us, what we like to call our consciousness, and that we are, for instance, just now beginning to see some of the results of this. Tomorrow I want to talk, for instance, about the issue of mysticism in the broad sense in America as one response to some of the new changes that have taken place, and ask the question whether or not we are a nation of mystics. And there are other examples of this, the human potential movement, for instance, sensitivity groups, and so on, new communities. All these are kinds of religious responses in terms of new religious lifestyles to the new world, what Schuller calls the Big Revolution, but they're really only beginnings. Now, to make a definition here, what Schuller means by the Big Revolution, in terms of these changes taking place, and I'll quote him directly here, is what he calls the expansion of the rights of the individual. The expansion of the rights of the individual and a reduction of the pressures of the culture on the individual. I'll repeat that. That the expansion of the rights of the individual and a reduction of the pressures of the culture on the individual, or society, if you like, on the individual. And to that, I think this is a profound change that's taken place, and I would simply just add myself there. Remember also the energy crunch and then the decreasing birth rate. Sure. The expansion of the rights of the individual. I know I talk, you know, I warned him that I talk faster than anybody here. So anyway, the expansion of the rights of the individual and a reduction of the pressures, or reduction of the pressures for conformity on the individual. I'll give some examples of this in a little while. Maybe that'll make it clear. An expansion or reduction, I should say, of the pressures of the culture on the individual. Now,
more space for the individual.
More space for the individual, far less how should I say this, far less pressure to conform to the norms and the standards of society for this. So what we have in the 1960s, for instance, and certainly have lasted, this has lasted well into the 1970s, is people have identified far more with special interest groups than they have with what we call society at large. Let me read what Sidney Ahlstrom says about this as talking about the 1960s. And he's talking about this attitude about the future here. A far more profound source of pessimism towards the future is the fact that human beings are sensitive, easily hurt, fragile, and insecure. To establish their identity and to actualize their values, they need the support of a group. This requires them to define themselves over against some other group or groups in one way or another, some benign and some virulently malignant. And at the same time, there are other various moral and religious forces in America which create a highly competitive social order that accelerates social change and produces special forms of strain, alienation, and resentment. In other words, in the 60s, as some of these big changes start taking place, what happens so often in American society, and it's lasted into the 70s, is people join, as I say, certain special interest groups and see themselves not so much simply as, as Christians or as Americans or as Virginians or as Mississippians or whatever, but they start seeing themselves in terms of, for instance, their sex. We have the women's movement getting started. We have the black movement getting started, the Chicano movement, the Native American movement, the student movement getting started out at Berkeley, you remember, in 1964 with this free speech movement, and so on. And we have other groups, for instance, taking their own special interests much more seriously. We have, for instance, just to use my own example that I know of so well, in Minnesota, the teachers' union is much, much stronger in this period than it ever had been before. We just had in the town next to ours, Faribault, Minnesota, the second longest strike by high school teachers in all of American history. And Faribault isn't exactly, a hotbed of political radicalism by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, my next door neighbor, is Judy Metzke, was the leader of the Faribault Educational Association and the leader of the strike. And Judy is very stable, normal. She doesn't read Marx, at night, under the cover or anything else like this. But now the teachers simply start thinking of themselves in terms of special interest groups, and they're ready to, put this on the line. Or another example of this, of what I mean by special interest groups, you remember California last year or the year before, who 10 years ago would ever have thought that MDs would have gone out on strike? I'm the possibility of that happening a few years ago, was simply wasn't within the realm of, our imagination. And now it has happened. And I'm not going to debate the pros or cons of it, but simply... Is it red and white now?
No, but you
have it. Yeah. And what they call a work reduction and so on. But you see what I'm trying to suggest here is that the 60s produced this kind of special interest and realigned the way in which people started thinking about what they want from themselves and how they would relate to society for this. Let me give you a couple of further examples of what I'm trying to talk about here, so far as the expansion of the rights of the individual and the reduction of the pressures of the culture on the individual are concerned. For instance, we now have legislation, I think, in every state which is aimed at making conditions better for the handicapped. Now it's required that the street corners, for instance, will have access for handicapped buildings, streets. Handicapped have more protection so far as employment is concerned. Or if you like to put it in another sense, we now are divided. Another way of dividing up people is that we now have in restaurants protection for non-smokers, which we didn't have before, which I kind of like because I don't. And as a result, we have legislation there, which means more complexity, which means that we have to have people enforcing these things. But if we want people, and if we don't want to be bothered by smoke in a restaurant, we have to have more complexity. We have to have more red tape in order to have this particular thing to take it taken care of. Or take another example in public schools, in reduction on the pressure of the individuals. When I went to school, and this lasted for a long time, we used to have 5 or 6 periods a day of 50 or 55 minutes a day, and that's the way it went. You went from German to art to whatever it was, and so on. And now we have modular scheduling, which is far more flexible, which is far more open to the needs of individuals rather than the old authoritarian model where everything had to be fitted into a into an older schedule, period. And a lot of teachers, my wife teaches foreign languages, and she was amused by modular scheduling because a lot of foreign language teachers were resistant to it because they had had all their verb conjugation worksheets worked out so that everything would work, you know, according to 50, 55 minutes. And they really didn't want changes because, I mean, heaven forbid they'd have to make up new lesson plans. And heaven preserve us from having to make up new lesson plans. But it wasn't, you know... I could, you know, many, many more examples of this. Or take another example of the increase in the rights of the individual. Take the military. In the Army, we no longer have KP. They hire people to do KP. They no longer have Reveille. Believe it or not, I mean, if any of you who are old GIs didn't know this, it's too good to be true, but it has actually happened. They don't have inspection more than, I think, once a month or something along these lines. They have beer, for instance, sold in the barracks, and you can hang, you know, psychedelic up or whatever posters, you know, in your barracks. And all I remember those bleak old days where everything was either gray or brown or drab green, variations thereof. All right. The same thing is true in our religious lives. For instance, we don't expect the ministers, for instance, to dress up the way we used to. Ministers always had to wear white shirts everywhere, and women always wore hats in church on Sunday. And heaven forbid, you know, if you didn't. All right, you get the idea here. Now beyond that, though, those evidences are less, I think the big revolution, this increase in the rights of the individual and decrease of the pressure of conformity to society, the big revolution has created a whole new attitude towards this stage in life which we call youth or young adulthood. By young adulthood, I mean about 18 to 25. And we no longer expect, I think, youth or young adults to conform or bend to traditional expectations. In fact, now, according to Schuller, we look to that age group for many of our clues and directions of, you know, of our sense of understanding. What is happening to us? We are extending the time period in which young people are being introduced into the world of adulthood. Traditionally, this period has been one in which the older society instructed or inculcated basic values towards work, leisure, family, religion into the younger age group. But all this has changed. Just as one example of the change here in the population, which will make a difference so far as our religious lifestyle is concerned, I'm drawing on, you know, every 10-year period because we have a census every 10 years. The number of adults over 25 between 1959 and 1969 increased 9%. The number of adults over 25 between 1959 and 1969 increased 9%. But those between 18 and 25 increased in that same decade 26.3%. So you see there is a tremendous change that's taken place there so far as our population is concerned, and that particular bulge, so to speak, in the population on this. All right. So much for really for generalizations. What really does all this make so far as specific differences, you know, in our life? Why should we, what can we do with all this kind of information? I think, as I've suggested before, two institutions which concern us here are our schools and our churches. In both cases, I think the big revolution that I mentioned is forcing us to move away from the image of authority and power in which the school or the church, by its tradition, had a program or services to offer, and the interested citizen or person would simply come to it with really few questions. I think all that's changed now. Churches and schools recognized the best, in fact, the only way to motivate the participants is not by authority or power. Take a look at what's happened in the Roman Catholic Church, for instance. You just don't give them the magisterium anymore and say, you know, that's it. Go back to Peter or anything. I suppose the Roman Catholic Church would be the best example of what I mean by the tremendous changes that have taken place. Probably in the 1960s, my own feeling is that if you look at American religious life, that will be the one institution where there have been more profound changes, long-range changes taking place in any other institution, really. It's just unbelievable what's happened there. Anyway, that the only way to motivate participants is not by authority or power, but by recognition of each according to their own particular needs and interests, and getting them involved as quickly as possible. Now, what this means, of course, in school life or in church life is, for instance, by having what we would call the needs of the participant rather than sort of the authority of the institution come first, is that classrooms are far more noisier. My wife, for instance, used to travel around to five different schools before we consolidated in Northfield and teach French to children grades 4, 5, and 6. And she couldn't help but obviously notice the difference in all the fourth grade rooms in the different districts. And this is a very good example, really. And there were those who were very authoritarian, who had their, you know, their game plan set and, you know, everything right down the line. And she would walk in there and it would be, you know, just like a morgue. But as so far as, you know, some people were concerned, if everything was quiet, that must mean everything was going well. because at least they were quiet. So if they were quiet, they must be learning, but obviously they weren't. And she had one school at a little country school out in Dundas, fourth grade, Mrs. Aldrich, where everything was, you know, very noisy and animated and chattering. Things were, you know, cluttered. Things were on the floor, heaven forbid. Students were walking around, you know, they didn't even have their desks in order. They didn't have everything neat and nice. I don't even think she had row monitors, you know, for all these things, but the kids were really learning. And she had a better response, for instance, there than she did from any of the other classes. In other words, she was meeting the students where they were at rather than saying, here is what we're going to learn today, you know, take it or, you know, leave or something else like that. So that's what I'm trying to say. The big revolution really isn't as efficient. Classrooms are noisier. Or on the parish level, church council meetings take longer. Now that we have to have everybody represented, we have youth and women and senior citizens, and goodness knows all these other ones are now represented. They take longer, but that's simply necessary because people aren't willing just to let, you know, a handful run the parish the way they used to. But where personal interests, I think, dominate over those of tradition, the programs seem to succeed better. I think that is one key element in understanding our new religious lifestyles. We simply can't, as I've suggested before, win people over by telling them this is the way it has always been. Or taking another example of what I'm getting at here, I think another prediction for the future that is always safe, since Benjamin Franklin made it 200 years ago, and he was right that the only things we can count on in life are death and taxes. I think the taxes will continue to go up, the cost of living will go up, the cost of energy will go up, and so too will our costs, you know, for schools and churches. Now, schools have the advantage, obviously, in large part of access to tax revenue, but churches rest or survive squarely on the basis of voluntary participation, both in their program and in their finances. All right. So the churches face some very real problems here with mounting costs, mounting taxes, I mean, raising taxes and so on. And what this will probably mean is that the churches are going to find themselves in a very real squeeze because costs are going to continue to go up, but the number of parishioners available is going to go down. If the birth rate continues to decline, and if there are a decline in the number of young adults, because this is the age group traditionally that doesn't go to church, you know, after confirmation, before the first child comes, there's a big sort of pause in which from about 15 to 25 or so that they really aren't, you know, that involved in the church. If this is the case, then what the church will find themselves with, as I've suggested here, is both less revenue and fewer participants. Now, one solution to this, according to Schuller here, is that we can rely far more than we ever have before on volunteers, especially, I think, for the near future of volunteers who are perhaps in the older age brackets rather than the young age brackets. What I'm suggesting here is that in our concern with religious lifestyles, that our congregations may well have to keep up with rising costs and with diminishing numbers by themselves having to reduce staff and relying more on volunteers. Now, this is not as efficient, to be sure, nor as desirable, since I think it's fair to say a few full-time people can probably do more than a large number of volunteers. But with increasing demands for services by pastors, especially for counseling services, I think, more time for visitations and all the rest, somewhere along the line, we're going to have to find some other way to meet these needs and have been met at this time. All right. Now, to look at it a slightly different way, what has happened in the churches, I think, as well as in the government and in schools, is that in these institutions, the services we provide have become far more complex. The services we provide in the churches, the government, the schools have become far more complex. Let me give you one example. Take the one-room schoolhouse of 1935. And some of these were very good. I found invariably students who came from one-room schoolhouses are very well prepared because one of them told me I had a student from Good Thunder, Minnesota, would you believe? But anyway, Good Thunder, and he had listened to, you know, the older lessons from the students, you know, in the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. So by the time he got there, he was very well prepared, and he had far more, you know, attention and so on. And so sometimes I wonder how well it is to close down the old one-room schoolhouses. But you look at that, and then you look at the schools today, and the schools are providing far more, you know, varied services than they were in, let's say, 1935. For people with speech defects, for learning defects, we have special education programs. We have driver education programs, sex education programs, a whole host of new services. And this is what, you know, we want. This is true also with hospitals. This is true with churches. What Schuller says has happened here, and in a way we've created our own problem, is that we've become far more concerned with human need. We're far more sensitive to human need than we were, let's say, you know, 20 years ago. And as this has happened, our churches, our schools, and our government have become far more complex. Schuller states it's virtually almost a law here, and I quote, "The greater the emphasis on human needs, the more costly the response. For instance, we have better medical care now. We have better public education, better highway construction. anti-pollution controls, and so on. All of this is what we want, but all of this obviously costs a great deal of money. It takes time, it takes energy, commitment, preparation, and skill. And we say we want person-oriented pastors or teachers or ministers. And of course, that's fine, but obviously this is going to require a significant price. So what I'm suggesting here is that certain choices regarding our lifestyle, our religious lifestyles, will have to be made if we want to continue to function at all, I think, in the near future. Now, specifically, here are a couple of examples of what might be done by way of concrete examples. I think parishes, for instance, might want to rely far more on volunteers. And as they rely far more on volunteers, especially as the date of retirement goes down, and I would suggest within a few years, I think Social Security will go down to about the age of 60. I really think with the increase in number of people available and all the rest, that we're going to see that within a short period of time. They're talking about 62 seriously now, and I would suggest that 60 is going to come in a short time, which would mean that if we can work Social Security out, that there are going to be more people still in their prime with much more free time. And this is going to be a remarkable pool, as Holden, for instance, has found here itself, for sources of volunteers. Now, at the same time you have more volunteers, what this might mean is a reduction, you see, in trained staff, which will mean a much less efficient kind of parish, because all of you know how easy it is or how convenient it is to have a well-trained staff who you give one order to or one proposal to, and it's done, rather than calling people in and coaxing them through committees and people don't show up for helping and so on. But when the costs keep going up and the number of participants keeps going down, this may make a difference. A second suggestion might be one which is actually carried out at a famous parish in Washington, D.C. Some of you know the Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C., where there is a very strong emphasis on what we call discipleship. In that particular congregation, they are required to give a fixed percentage of their income. And also spend donate a fixed amount of hours per week to the work in the congregation. Otherwise, they are simply invited to leave the congregation. It's small in terms of numbers, but they do require a high level of discipleship, and apparently it's one of the most active, flourishing, and exciting parishes in all of America. I've got some write-ups about it, and I'd be glad to share these at another session. Al Pitcher and I are talking about doing something with communities. And I'd be happy to share some of the information I have on Church of the Savior there. What I'm suggesting here is that since we are going to be facing a revenue crunch in the near future, it may be well for congregations to put more emphasis on disciplined stewardship and on discipleship itself, which in a way is a high price to pay, because we always like to we cherish the idea of voluntary giving. I think that's a very important thing. But it may be too big a luxury to have in the future. If costs are going to continue to go up and people are going to be faced with different kinds of alternatives so far as what their revenue is concerned, unless there is some kind of disciplined approach to stewardship, both in time and in commitment, energy and in revenue, it may well be that some parishes are going to find themselves simply on the outside looking in and finding themselves declining and maybe even disappearing, as has been the case in some. Or another example of what might be done by way of responding to these long-range changes we've been talking about, I'm glad I'm at the end because my voice is too, is that in a larger, metropolitan area, some parishes might well think about merging with other parishes so far as utilization of resources are concerned. If, for instance, there seems to be a need for a new parish, in a community. We've seen, for instance, around Northfield, one Apple Valley has just sort of instantly appeared out of nowhere, and suddenly they have their own high school and so on. If there seems to be the need for a new parish, why not share the building, for instance? Why not have a new parish use the church for Sunday afternoon services? We like to think that the only time, we put it this way, we've made one breakthrough in many areas. We have Friday night services now for people who want a long weekend. We have Friday night church because the family wants to go off in the Winnebago for Saturday and Sunday. So we're getting away from the idea that church has to be on Sunday morning. What's the matter with having a small congregation which wants to get started be able to use another parish on Sunday afternoon so that they can avoid the huge expense of a mortgage and paying that off over a long period of time? Or in a larger setting, for instance, the churches are using their resources for day schools, for nurseries, for programs for senior citizens, for youth, and so on. It may well be that in in larger cities, according to Schuller here, you can specialize so that one church will have just daycare, one church in nearby may have just facilities for senior citizens, and one for something else, whatever it might be, so that you can make better and more efficient use. You can do just one thing in each parish. Or, for instance, if you need, since we'll need, most congregations need business managers, why not have one business manager for several parishes, rather than have somebody, you know, amateurs, really, in a sense, in each parish try to do the best they can. Have one specialized person do it for the whole thing. And otherwise, in other words, could have created a centralized source here and simply recognize that the functions of the parish have become so specialized. And this is really what we want. We want these different programs, that the best thing to do is to meet it as efficiently as possible. Okay, let me summarize here. As we demand, and I think quite rightly, as we demand more person-centered services from our institutions, these institutions will become more complex, and we will involve the participation of more people in order to operate well. Okay, let me summarize here. As we demand, and I think quite rightly, as we demand more person-centered services from our institutions, these institutions will become more complex, and we will involve the participation of more people in order to operate well. Our churches really, in this sense, will not survive, I think, by momentum or by wishful thinking, by claims to authority or tradition, or this is the way we have always done it. As we move towards more person-centered services, as the institutions become more complex, the institutions themselves will probably be resistant to change. And this is where I think the danger, the trouble lies. And the more resistance there appears, the more temptation there will be to delay the problems. And the more we delay the problems, I think, the more difficult they will be to solve in the future. So, granted, the premises really that Schuller talks about here, we will have increasingly high costs, we'll have less income, fewer people, and more pressures for person-centered services, and more resistance to change. And I have no magic blueprint which will work for each person or for each congregation. But I suggest that each of us as individuals and as congregations can perhaps better understand some of the changing lifestyles in America if we give attention to some of these trends which I think are at work now. And I would like to throw it open for your consideration as to whether or not this makes sense at all, whether or not this is simply some church bureaucrats, you know, speculating. I don't think so. I think there's a great deal to what Schuller has to say here, and that it may well be that the traditional parish, which has always been sort of a haven for security and stability and all the rest, is going to face some very difficult times.
In sharing the church, we do that at St. Luke's in Minneapolis.
Yeah, how does that work, Andy? Yeah.
The Lathian church comes in half an hour afterwards and has Sunday school, and then about an hour after we're through in church, they come in and use our, and we get along fine.
The Latvian.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a special interest who want to stay together.
Right.
Yeah. Which would be a good example of some of these trends that I've talked about here, who don't feel that simply because they're in America, they have to join a, quote, an American church. And perhaps as, you know, society becomes more complex, more groups like this will continue to appear, rather than less than fewer.
In Missouri, we have the St. Andrews, to which I belong, an LCA church, and not far away, perhaps six blocks, is Trinity Presbyterian. We have about the same type of congregation, almost all young people up to middle age. I think I'm the oldster. And Trinity has the same type of congregation. We do many things together, and especially youth work. And and it's working out very successfully. We've been doing it the last 5 or 6 years. And we have Thanksgiving services jointly, and quite a few projects. Vacation Church School is held in our church every year for both churches and for the entire community. We're also very community-minded. and we're doing all this great deal of work in the community, and it's proving very, very fine. We're getting recognition even from others in the city because of the work we're able to do together.
You're going out and to find out what the needs of the community are.
And we're...
And making your program...
We're using the facilities. We're building, we have very small facilities up to now. We're just building a $250,000 functional building. No pews, just stackable chairs. With Civic as architect.
Oh, fine. Good. Yep.
And it's going to make us even more, give us more facilities for community activities. We're actually the only building available in the entire section, the western part of the city, for some distance. That has any facilities at all. For example, the Boy Scouts, we have a tremendously large group. And we have the Neophytes meeting there, and the Weavers Guild, and the League of Women Voters, we have excellent parking facilities. So we not only have church organizations, but many other community activities there.
And the it's open...
Trinity Presbyterian Church is extremely interested, and we're working with them too on prison reform and working with inmates of the state prison at Jefferson City on the Trinity's main project. Mm.
That may be, well, you know, a trend in the future. Maybe some of the rest of you are doing this, where community activities are being done on what you call an interdenominational basis.
Yes, very much so.
Rather than having the Lutherans doing this and then the Presbyterians doing the same thing and so on down the line.
Erling, Bob? You commented on the increased dependence on volunteers. Do you see along with that, increased training or working with or equipping of those volunteers?
Yeah, that...
I think we've in the church run a kind of dynamic that we're trying to face now in Pullman of the clergy has said, go and minister. Congregation has said, I'm scared.
Yeah.
And we said, go do it anyway, it'll work. You know, well, an amazing number of people have, and you know, by God's grace and a little good luck and a few other things, it has worked. But we haven't really done much to upgrade that ministry.
Yeah, I think this is where church offices, district presidents' offices and all the rest can furnish the kind of training really here which is necessary, the supplied ministry. That's Roger Feld, isn't it, right, from the national office. But I think on the district level, this is what the district can do so very well, is that through training sessions or week-long sessions, whatever, maybe weekend programs and all the rest, workshops, all these sorts of things, that's what the district can do. Because each district is a little bit different. I mean, Minneapolis is different than Council Bluffs and Keokuk. And therefore, you can have Bob, my classmate Bob Evans up in Minneapolis, doing something for inner city missions because he knows that so well. And I only mention that because Bob is working now for our district president. He's behind the desk rather than out in the parish. And I think he'll get back into the parish pretty soon. But that would be the place, I think the church could do an enormous... I mean, where church offices can do an enormous amount. People say that we're too top-heavy with the bureaucrats, but I don't think so if they can provide these kinds of services, and I know that's what they're doing, to help with the volunteer work. Now, that's going to take more time.
Along with that, does he suggest things like the establishments of... we have various professional buildings now, primarily doctors or primarily dentists. Does he see a centralizing of not just a business staff person, that it becomes business manager for all of these places, but the centralizing of the church offices as well?
Yeah, that's a very real possibility to save costs on office equipment, for instance, which is a very...
Plans.
Yeah, right, and a very real need, especially in the larger cities where there are common interests. He's not suggesting bringing rural and urban people together because the interests and the programs are so different, but where they have this sort of thing, yes, definitely. And it'll mean, in one sense, it'll mean, a little sort of depersonalization because everything is done in a more business-like manner, but on the other hand, it'll free up other resources for for work on meeting human needs. It's simply, you know, like everything else in society, becoming, you know, more specialized and cutting costs where you can cut costs without paying the price of, you know, losing the human touch, right? Yes?
Instead of thinking in terms of how to save money and to be more efficient and by using more volunteers and keeping our structure just about the way it is now, that's what I hear people saying. It seems to me we need to think about a whole new way of looking at it as a possibility, because not, there are some factors that you've spoken of today that seems to me are working directly against each other. The energy crunch, the increase in cost, the decline in population. There's simply going to be some empty places where there's just no way, I don't care how efficient your staff is, are you going to have any bodies to minister to? Mm. And that this group of 29-some% between 15 and 25, which is where this big increase in our population of very elderly people, as we become more and more secular and more freed from institutions, we are going to have fewer and fewer worshiping Christians. And for every church to scramble to try to have the best scouts or the best counseling or the best art group or the best this, means that we are sort of competing against each other for people. And that rather than to think in those terms, to find some way to revitalize our life as under God, as people in the world, so that we are really yeast in the whole lump, instead of trying to hug the lump, you know, and then keep punching the yeast into it and saying, this is my area that I'm going to be in. We're going to be in the world more, and fed and nurtured and supporting each other as we move out into the world as a vision of the church.
Yeah, I think that this is very, I agree, this is very difficult, because we've always had this question, should the world write the agenda for the church, or vice versa, and especially Reformation churches are leaning the other direction, and this is why I was so impressed with what you say about your congregation, because this seems to be what's happening there, is that the community is non-competitive about this, but there is a great deal of cooperation. I was only talking today about the structures. Tomorrow I want to talk more about sort of the content, about revitalization of religious lifestyles, but looking at more practical problems today, because tomorrow I want to get way off in mysticism someplace, and I sort of wanted the contrast, but I agree with you. I thought that's a very, very cogent point, really, and one which I would simply underline. Yeah, Don?
The role of the clergy has been changing also, and and I think that the clergy has been struggling too with these changes that have been occurring the last 10, 15 years.
Yes.
It has affected, I think, the growth of the parish. And I think that in a lot of instances, the clergy has felt threatened. And because maybe seminaries, maybe the church institution hasn't given them the tools to deal with the problems of the time, right?
Yes.
Some interesting things are happening now, like our parish, we have a guy that's just a minister of parish life development, and his responsibility is training lay people and developing the committee structure so that committees do function.
That's solid, boy. If you can get a committee to function, I want to know, right? Send me, really.
And I would say that most of the committees the last year or so are really functioning and are really, I think we're ministering to a variety.
Yeah.
And also this whole idea, you know, I've experienced a couple things the last couple years, coming from a Midwest congregation where the population in the congregation is going like this, but stewardship has gone like that. And it seems like there's been a real big commitment gap now, that people are lining up, the committed are lining up on one side, and the so-so's on the other side, and there seems to be some antagonism between the two churches. Also,
it doesn't have to be.
I think within the Lutheran church, coming out of a different background, only being Lutheran 5 years, that the Lutherans are still now getting onto this idea of evangelism. And we've relied, I think our heritage has been having babies and baptizing them, is how our church has grown in the past. And we've done some surveys in our congregation, and a little more than 40% of our parish are non-Lutherans that have been attracted to our congregation, have usually been that group after high school that has fallen out, and through some personal struggles and some personal searches, have come back in and they've found maybe the program and the needs being met in the parish. But we're going to, looks like now, 1st of January, hire a full-time minister of evangelism in our Lutheran parish for outreach. All kinds of apartment houses, all kinds of
New styles, but you're going out to the apartment buildings rather than expecting them to come to you and meeting them where they're at, right? Yeah, that's what I'm suggesting, right? Evelyn, and then...
Do you, in anything you're for example, different ethnic groups, or do you see more going back to separate? I'm talking about, you know, different races or, let's say, economic level.
Well, I would...
For the future, because, I mean, I was here.
Sure.
Do you see women more coming together?
Well, I think the congregation at worship probably will continue to function where you don't have age groups or special interest groups. But I think so far as other areas of life are concerned, the more applied areas beyond worship, I think it'll the fragmentation will increase rather than decrease. And I don't know any, I don't know if that's always...
How about the church, though? I mean, because it seems to be going that way now, fragmentation. But how about the church for the future?
Well, my only feeling there is if the revenue crunch and the membership decline become serious enough, we may simply have a survival mentality take place in which, if you're going to survive, you're going to have to really, everybody's going to have to pull their own share of the oar. And I suspect in some places, I know that's happened in some places already, and that's what I think will continue. And maybe that's good. Maybe somehow that's good, that we've become too fat and too complacent. And so, and one thing I have to say for the church is that is an unfair comment, is that the churches are top-heavy with bureaucrats. Especially, I can only speak for the Lutheran churches, but the three major bodies, because I remember Kent Knutson, when he was president, made an interesting little comment. He counted up the number of decision-making officials down there at 422 South Fifth. He counted up who really are, can be considered, classic bureaucrats sitting behind the desk firing off memos to the district presidents and so on. And there were fewer decision-making officials in the ALC headquarters than there were total number of teachers in his high school, in his daughter's junior high school out in the St. Paul suburb. There were more teachers in one junior high than there were decision makers for the ALC, which has a membership of, 2.5 million? I think something like that, which would indicate that there's hardly, and some of you know the big, this restructuring that just took place a couple of years ago, where they dropped, where they consolidated and dropped and so on. I don't think that's just my little thing I had to get off the chest.
One thing I've become aware of, I'm on long range planning for our church, which is Central Lutheran in Minneapolis.
Oh, fine.
We keep seeking for things and methods and gimmicks, but what we seem to be forgetting is a basic, down-to-earth, in-depth Bible study and knowledge of the gospel and of the Bible and of what it's all about. Like our study this morning. Quite a few of us here, I think, have turned to Bible study fellowship, and we're saying that this is something we don't get in our churches.
Yeah.
And until we get that, I don't think we're going to get the growth.
What are the rest of you? I was only talking about structures and finances and that sort of thing today.
They all come from that.
I mean, you have to want to belong to church,
yes.
Yeah. That's true. The first basic commitment to church membership. Mm-hmm. To discipleship, if you like, is right. I'm only suggesting that the other things have to, be taken into account too, because otherwise we may not have the facilities, right? Because Central, I think, has done a remarkable job, because so many other congregations have, with large, big sort of cathedral-type buildings, have simply let these churches turn into what virtually become museums. And unless they've been, because so many people have moved out. If some of you know New York, where we lived for a year, Church of the St. John of the Divine on 110th in Amsterdam is virtually just a museum where people go. It's a beautiful thing. It's fantastic, but it really doesn't have much of a program of outreach. And I watch what Central does and some of the other churches do, and I think it's remarkably well done, because they have realized that the church is more than simply a nice place to come to when you're dressed up on Sunday morning.
But the thing is, with a membership of 5,600, you could expect just a burgeoning, relay program felt throughout the city. If the people involved in the congregation were committed to this mission.
Yeah, I see.
There could be so much more.
Yes.
They're not involved.
It's possible, though, that churches should do what Church of the Savior does, is physically require more participation. We hate to do that, because we like to think that every person should decide for themselves how much input they should have into the church life.
And I think losing pledges is another reason for not doing this.
Losing pledges? Yeah, I agree. Yes?
They have to start. I don't understand what you're talking about, financial losses that churches have you have to pay a certain amount of money to go to church.
Well, you know, it's like when you ask a college for financial help, you have to fill out a long form. For some outfit of Princeton has this, I forget the initials. And if you join the Church of the Savior, you have to declare what your income is, your actual take-home pay is, and then you pledge a certain percentage of that to the congregation. And it's sort of like keeping up pledges, you know, that you're required to. You work it out. I mean, it isn't a fixed, I mean, it isn't 10% or 15 or 20%. I mean, there's flexibility there, obviously, because different people have different needs in terms of other kinds of obligations and so on. But you make a commitment, and that all I'm saying is that in Church of the Savior, it's enforced. And the same thing is true in time. Like, you two nights a week or whatever it might be, Saturday afternoons.
It's more self-enforced than enforced by somebody else.
Yes,
the corporate
right.
decision of the group of worshiping people rather than somebody...
It isn't the assistant principal seeing if you showed up in class today or something, you know, and checking it off. No, really. But it's self-imposed, and that's the best kind because it's voluntary. And you're there because you really want to be and you're committed to it. Yeah?
I was just going to say, too, smooth off the sharp corners of that Cuban thing. This is done in a very warm way in some new house churches that are springing up. They are realizing the obligation, and they're just doing it because they want their group to continue.
And I think probably, I'll wind it up with that if we are faced, since we are going to be faced with these problems, then the voluntary element is going to be all the more important, and maybe it's all for the best, because when people are in church because they really want to be, then probably there's not so, maybe we shouldn't be quite so pessimistic about the future, because there may be fewer people in church, but the people who are there are better committed.
Watch out for the pessimism of the 18 to 25 year old class as well.
Yeah. Yes.
That pessimism may have been existent in the, or it's still, I think, a residual of the 60s.
Yeah. Yes.
And that pessimism is not justified, I don't think, in the 70s.
Now, this showed up last week. I don't know if any of you were here when we talked a couple issues last week, and we had a three-way generation gap in here, and that exact age group is still very pessimistic. And so on. Today,
very pessimistic, but in terms of their pessimism in regard to their involvement, you serve a congregation in a university community where, quite frankly, three times as many university students are involved as members of the parish, year-round members of the parish.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And when you had a Sunday of bad weather in the midst of the winter, the folk with their families stay home. The university students will be there.
Glad to hear it. There's hope. It's a different kind of parish, though. It's there because it meets their needs, and they're involved. They're committed. And that's good, right. Tomorrow we'll be in a whole different realm. I deliberately set up these two not opposites, but different things. Tomorrow we'll talk about having mystical religious experiences, which is a long ways away from budgets and computers and office equipment. Okay, thank you for coming. Mm-hmm.